Our next guest says there are a lot of similarities across decades, national boundaries, and continents among authoritarian leaders over the last century. And she includes former President Trump on this list. She says learning about how they rise to power, stay in power, use, and ultimately lose power can be helpful in preventing future figures from trying to destroy democratic governments. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about the history of authoritarian leaders? Do you see former President Trump in that category? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ruth Ben-Ghiat is a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. Her new book is called Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. Ruth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, I want to start out with a look at the character of Mussolini, somebody you've studied a lot. You describe him in the book as the first man to transform a democracy into a dictatorship. And you see themes that he starts pop up again and again to this day. What were some of the things you see in Mussolini that keep popping up in authoritarian strongmen ever since?
So Mussolini's we always think about Hitler for good reason, but Mussolini is more appropriate to understand how things work today because he was a prime minister in a democracy for 3 years before he declared dictatorship. So during that time, and there was no template for this, he was demonizing the press. He was, having leftists and other people, even leftist priests, jailed and doing everything to erode democracy. And when he declared dictatorship, it was to escape a corruption investigation, which is very contemporary. That's something that we have in the news today that Vladimir Putin is going after, Alexei Navalny, who exposed his corruption. So Mussolini had killed the socialist leader of the Socialist Party, but the guy was killed not just because he was an anti-fascist, but he was about to expose Mussolini's financial corruption. And to get out of the investigation, Mussolini declared dictatorship and shut the whole thing down.
And there are, you mentioned hostility toward the press, corruption. What are some of the other elements that you see in Mussolini coming up again and again? You highlight things like this machismo, virility almost. Can you talk about that a little as something that he established and we see again and again?
So one of the purposes of writing the book was to look at patterns that come up over and over again. And obviously I was writing as an American who was concerned with seeing these patterns occur in our time and place. So one thing that happens is that men like Mussolini find favor when a society has gone through a lot of social transformation. Could be gender emancipation. In that case, it was after World War One. It could be racial emancipation, workers' rights. And these are processes that make some people very uncomfortable. So Mussolini came up. He had been a journalist, which is very important because he was extremely good at mass communication. And many of these men are highly skilled at manipulating the crowd, at saying and being exactly what people need them to be at that moment. And they use their bodies very effectively. So the machismo, I have a chapter on virility. And I wanted to take that seriously because it's easy to laugh where we have, Mussolini stripping his shirt off to thresh wheat, pretending to be a peasant. Or we have Putin who goes fishing with his pecs all puffed up. But it's actually part of how they present themselves to their people as a protector, as an aggressor who's going to defend the nation. So I wanted to take that seriously. And so there too, Mussolini was the first world leader to engage in manual labor with his shirt off. And he and Putin are like bookends. Now, Trump doesn't show his own body, but when he tweeted in 2019 an image directly, it wasn't even a retweet, of his head photoshopped onto Sylvester Stallone's body, which was half naked, that was in this tradition.
Talking to Ruth Ben-Ghiat about her new book, Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on authoritarian dictators, leaders, whether you worry that the United States is vulnerable to being taken over by someone in this strong man tradition. Well, Ruth, I'm going to skip over a bunch of the history in your book and tackle the present day now. Donald Trump, you write, you can come back to again and again, you see him fitting into this strong man tradition. You've touched on a couple of the ways. Talk some more about that, please.
Yeah, so when I started writing about Trump in 2015, when I saw him holding rallies and having loyalty oaths, and then when I saw him, heard him say, you know, I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and not lose any followers, I grew highly alarmed because this is not how democratic with a small d leaders act. This is how people act who are going to follow a different playbook. And unfortunately, you know, Trump has a very similar temperament and personality to leaders of the past. Now, the outcome is different today. And I divide the book into three phases. There's fascist years, military coups, and today. So you don't have as many one-party states. But Trump, you know, with his hiring and firing constantly, with his constructing a cocoon of flatterers and family members around him, which makes for bad decision making, his incitements of aggression, his legitimation of extremism, his extreme egocentrism and impulsivity, all of this matches the personality profile of former leaders and gets translated into policy.
Now, there are people listening probably who are nodding along and agreeing. There are people listening who voted for President Trump once or twice and saying, well, wait a minute. I just wanted somebody who is going to shake up the system, some restore some of the values I want to see in American government. They wouldn't buy this picture of him as an authoritarian, at least potentially authoritarian strongman. What would you say to them?
Yeah, I mean, and of course, what people would say to me is, because I started writing about this in 2016, we can even stick to when he became president. Well, that's silly because you wouldn't be able to speak out if he were authoritarian. But everybody started somewhere. And, you know, what we see now of people like Erdogan in Turkey or who jails, you know, arrests hundreds of thousands, they started somewhere. And I really see Trump as following a different model of government. He never intended to govern in a traditional sense. And this was one of his strengths for people. They wanted somebody who would, he formed a movement. It's very important that he had a movement at the beginning, that he was going to shake up politics, that he communicated in a very different manner. All of these men have direct communications with their people, and he used Twitter. Like Mussolini and Hitler used radio and newsreels. And he spoke the language of emotion. And this really bonded people to him and made them think that he cared about them. He told them, I love you. My view is that this was a lot of manipulation. He's extremely skilled propagandist. And his goals were not those of regular governance of either party. His primary goal, which is why he spent one out of every 3 days at a Trump property, was to turn public office into a vehicle of private enrichment. That he worked very hard at visiting Trump properties on days he should have perhaps been in the White House. So I just see him as a different kind of ruler. And what happened on January 6th kind of is a logical extension of this different model of governance. Because my last chapter endings, the one thing that you know is that these men don't leave office quietly. And I had to turn in the book in the summer. And I didn't know how the election would go, but the last words I write about Trump is that he wasn't going to leave without fight. He wasn't going to go quietly.
Do you think the American system of representative government was at risk in that, especially in that period from the last election to Inauguration Day?
I don't think that the whole system was at risk, but it's very alarming if you look at that long period that opened up with him refusing to recognize the election. And it was quite notable to me that even the liberal leaders like Modi in India and Erdogan in Turkey had congratulated Biden, but Trump didn't. He wasn't going to do that. And the things he tried are straight out of the history of authoritarianism. So first he had kind of investigated some kind of military intervention. And then General Milley shut that down. So he came out of the blue with a declaration that said, we're not going to serve an individual, which is obviously Trump. We're going to serve the Constitution. And then he tried the election manipulation. And this is typical of 21st century authoritarians. Nowadays, you come to office through elections and you must manipulate elections to stay there. And you must have an avalanche of propaganda that makes people lose faith in the trustworthiness of their elections. And he did that on every level, at every part of the voting process. He tried to make people think that this was fraudulent or just uncertain. And that didn't work. He didn't have the right people in place, as in Georgia. And so he went for something that reminded me of early fascism, summoning these paramilitaries and non-state actors, although it turns out a lot of people from military and law enforcement, and they came to rescue their leader who had been robbed of something rightfully his. And that's very fascistic. So there's a lot to be alarmed about if you see the whole period of these last months as an assault on our system of democracy.
We're picking up our talk with Ruth Ben-Ghiat from New York University about her new book, Strongmen, Mussolini to the Present. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hello.
Hi. So I would actually like to make the argument that democracy is always fragile to strongmen just by its very nature, because in order to provide us with the freedoms that we cherish and hold dear, like freedom of the press, freedom of speech, so on and so forth, democracy by its very nature becomes weak to the very institutions which it is there to uphold and almost becomes vulnerable. I think it becomes incumbent upon each and every one of us that if we value the freedoms and the blanket of freedom that we sleep under, we need to do all of our own individual parts to make sure to maintain that and support it, because it could come down at any second. And
Thanks a lot for the call, Marcus. Ruth, he points toward, I think if anyone's the hero of your book, it's the people who in all these regimes resisted early, late, and survived, for that matter. Can you talk about what Marcus is pointing to as the role of citizens here?
Yeah, that's really important. And I one of the most moving chapters after writing, because the book has a bit of grimness to it, it wasn't very fun to write at times, was the resistance chapter. To see how people have resisted in so many ways, to see how mass nonviolent protest has been so important, but also how, it's true that we have taken democracy for granted in some ways, and it's something that we need to work at. We have to build democracy protection into our everyday lives, in a sense. And I think that certainly the Trump administration and January 6th have been a wake-up call, because democracy, to some extent, is an honor system. And men like Trump are not men of honor. In fact, they have, in Berlusconi in Italy, it was also like this. Their whole business model and life model was about inhabiting this gray zone between the illegal and the legal and seeing what they can get away with. So one of my conclusions in the book is that legal, like this kind of macho lawlessness, is at the heart of authoritarianism. And so citizens have to, in the wake of someone like Trump, it's very important for us to push back at to have, anti-corruption measures and accountability and transparency. And I think that to show by mobilizing, by being in touch with officials, that we care about these rights, that we care about officials acting with ethics in mind.
Let's go to another caller now. Nancy is with us in Managua. Nancy, hi.
Hi, I had a question. My question is that Mussolini had to be exiled in order for him to not cause problems in Italy. what then do you think is going to happen with, you know, Trump? And, you know, are we looking at him coming back? How do we get all the people that are still, you know, just constantly thinking everything he says was perfect? How do we get those people deprogrammed?
Nancy, thanks, Scott. Yeah. I remember. Oh, go ahead, Ruth.
No, go ahead.
I don't remember Mussolini being exiled. He was ultimately killed, I think. But the main point Nancy's raising, how do you make sure somebody doesn't make a comeback even after an initial defeat?
Yeah, it's hard to get them out of the system. Meaning even if they end up killed, it's hard to get the personality cults unbelievably can carry on. And I think that it's not clear that Trump is finished. I wrote an op-ed for the LA Times about how once personality cults are created, they continue on, and Trump will carry his 70 plus million voters with him and his cult of victimhood, which is absolutely crucial to leader cults and the success of authoritarianism. The leader is an aggressor, a protector, but he's also a victim. In our case, the deep state and prosecutors and all the usual likely suspects. So I don't think Trump's going to just fade away quietly. His ego needs and financial needs require him to continue to have some kind of public political role. So we haven't seen the last of him. I do think, to be more optimistic on this point, I think there were a number of voters who may not have loved Trump, but they were, I call them situational voters. They voted for Trump because they believed that Biden was going to mean the beginning of socialist apocalypse, ruin. And I think in 6 to 9 months, when they see that socialist apocalypse is not in fact arriving, that part of the voting public of Trump may be a little persuadable.
And Ruth, I want to take a couple minutes looking at the international connections between strongmen today. You point out that a lot of people in former President Trump's inner circle had contacts to some of the other characters in your book, from Putin to Erdogan and others. Is this an international movement in some ways?
It's very much an international movement. And one of the core things I argue is that these kinds of rulers are what's called personalist rulers. Their own personal private obsessions and needs, and including financial needs, come to influence domestic and foreign policy. And they wrap their parties around their fingers with all the loyalty quotients. And so with foreign leaders, they often privatize or personalize foreign policy. We don't know the full nature of Trump's relationship with Putin, but Berlusconi had a similar relationship with Putin in the early 2000s, and it was built on mutual financial deals that they were pursuing. The same with Erdogan of Turkey. We don't hear enough about Erdogan, who was the leader Trump talked to the most of any foreign leader. And he had William Barr as attorney general, do maneuvers to prevent the prosecution of a Turkish bank as a favor to Erdogan. So this is what I mean, this kind of this reduction or privatization almost of foreign policy. And there, what Kushner, his son-in-law, did with, Qatar, and all of this web of nebulous, nefarious, corrupt things that go on is souped up when you have a leader whose own personal well-being and financial prosperity becomes the center of governance for him.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Ruth, are you concerned that another similar figure could rise in the U.S. sooner than later?
I think that Trump's left a roadmap for sure, to, especially with election manipulation and election discrediting, that someone else could follow, getting the right people in place with a different outcome. But I also think that he's left a roadmap for us of what to do to shore up our democracy, to protect it, where the weak points are in our institutions, and the power of protest. And we can use that going forward too.
Ruth, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Ruth Ben-Ghiat, professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. We talked with her about her new book. It's called Strongmen, Mussolini to the Present.